Well, clearly, the clerical sexual abuse scandals that washed across Europe, beginning in Ireland and then popping up in Germany and Belgium and in the Netherlands and other places, which also then generated very difficult questions, particularly in the secular media, about the role of the Vatican and the role of the Holy Father himself in responding to all that, made the first half of 2010 an extraordinarily difficult period for the Church. I think at the end of it, there probably is a stronger consensus today, at least in terms of those who were not church insiders, who had not followed the arc of this story from the very beginning, that Pope Benedict XVI has a profile as a reformer on this issue. That is to say, that however inadequate one may want to argue that the Vatican's response has been to this question, I don't think there's any serious doubt that the former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the man who is today Pope Benedict XVI, has always been on the side of pushing for a more aggressive response. I think the fruit of the crisis, so to speak, and you know, one certainly would never wish for a trauma of that magnitude to make something clear, but nevertheless, I think what it has made clear is the point that Pope Benedict XVI is a man who, from the very beginning of this crisis, who has tried to come to terms with it and who has tried to cajole the Church, so to speak, into a more comprehensive and satisfactory response to it. Having said that, I think it is, however, clear that this crisis is not over. That, you know, for a long time we have been wondering as Catholics, when will we round the corner on this crisis? In the United States, when it blew up in 2002, there was hope that perhaps by the end of that year it would be over. I think what is clear is that the fallout of this crisis is with us for some time to come. It is with us in terms of the internal life of the Church, the rupture of trust that has occurred. It's with us externally in terms of the massive blow to the Church's moral credibility that this crisis has meant. And so while I think it is clear to anyone whose eyes are open that Pope Benedict XVI has moved the ball farther and faster than anyone else at senior levels of the Church on this question, I think it is also true that there's a lot of work left to be done.
Okay, let's turn now to some of the more positive elements of 2010. Perhaps one that stands out, particularly for the English-speaking world, was his trip to England and Scotland. Now, that was preceded by a lot of fairly hostile press coverage, particularly in the secular or aggressively atheist sectors of society. And yet, it was a successful trip, wasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, you're right. There was this drumbeat prior to the trip, sort of predictions of gloom and doom. I mean, the whole thing was introduced by a flurry of speculation that the Pope might somehow be arrested and thrown into jail when he set foot in the UK for his role in the sexual abuse crisis. Others had predicted there would be massive public protests, massive blowback in the streets when he came to the UK. And of course, none of that materialized. The contrary, I think Benedict XVI, as he always does when he travels, I have to say, came across as an extraordinarily thoughtful, warm, and positive public figure. And I'll tell you, my window into that was, I was doing the commentary for CNN during the Pope's visit. And at the end of it, I had to stay in London because I was on the CNN set to do the color commentary, so to speak, for that day. And afterwards, I and a number of the CNN producers went to a pub around the corner to sort of debrief. And one of the English TV channels had the ongoing coverage of the trip. And we were sitting next to a couple of guys who were your kind of classic, secular, unchurched, fundamentally dubious about Catholicism kind of guys. And they were listening to the Pope speak about the positive role that religion can play in public life in the UK. And one of them said to the other, "Well, I guess he's not so crazy after all." To me, I mean, that symbolized, yes, you know, what a breakthrough this trip was, that a pope who came into the UK carrying some fairly significant baggage, let's admit. He was identified with a sexual abuse scandal. He was identified with positions on public issues that don't play well in some circles of English public opinion, who was seen as a kind of fire-breathing, finger-wagging, draconian moralist, somehow succeeded reintroducing himself to the English public as someone who was deeply sympathetic with where English society is moving and wants the Church to play a positive role in that conversation. To me, it was a real watershed moment.
Other foreign visits that the Pope made this last year took him to Malta, Portugal, Spain, and Cyprus. What stands out in your view about any of the things he said or did during these pastoral visits? Is there any kind of anecdote that you can share with us?
I mean, certainly the trip to Malta stands out because it was yet another occasion in which Benedict XVI met with victims of clerical sexual abuse. And I had the opportunity to interview a couple of those victims after the meeting took place. And I remember them recounting, while they themselves were weeping, talking about the tears the Pope himself had in his eyes when the meeting took place and how much they felt his pastoral concern for their suffering.
Were they still angry afterwards?
Oh, well, of course. Look, I mean, there's a legitimate policy debate to be had about decisions the Holy See has made or not made or how the local church has responded. But beyond all that, I think the fundamental question many people have had since the outset of this crisis is, does the Pope get it? I mean, in his heart, does he understand the pain that this crisis has wrought for so many people? And I think for those victims, and now there have been five meetings between Benedict and victims of sexual abuse. For those who have been in the room with him, had the opportunity to tell their stories to him and listen to him reach out to them, I don't think for those victims there's any doubt that the Pope does get it, that the Pope is personally heartsick about this crisis and is committed in every fiber of his being to try to do what he believes the Church needs to do to try to bring this suffering to an end. So I think that certainly that experience stands out. I would say the trip to Cyprus stands out largely because since he was elected, there is this kind of rap on Benedict XVI that he is excessively Eurocentric and concerned only about the vicissitudes of contemporary Europe. Well, Cyprus was a point of departure for him to talk about the situation that Christianity faces in the Middle East, and it, of course, was the prelude to the Synod on the Middle East, that is a gathering of about 300 bishops from around the world overall from the Middle East that took place in Rome in October. And what came out of those two experiences was how personally engaged and committed Benedict XVI is to the fate of the Christian community and the Catholic Church in the Middle East, particularly in places where, to be quite honest, the Church is getting its teeth kicked in, and one thinks immediately of places like Iraq.
Well, indeed, that massacre that happened shortly after the end of the Synod.
And I think it is incredibly important to have these testimonies of the Pope's personal commitment to not only the well-being, but the raw survival of Christian communities in those parts of the world where they are, of course, incredibly imperiled.
Now, this year didn't see the release of any encyclicals by Pope Benedict, but it did see some important papal documents. Let's talk first of all about the Apostolic Constitution, which set out a structure for traditionalist Anglicans to join the Catholic Church. I mean, how significant do you see that, and what waves is it continuing to make?
Well, I think the sociological significance of the document that created these new structures, these so-called personal ordinariates for former Anglicans, remains to be seen. We don't really know what the market, so to speak, is going to be, how many former Anglicans are going to sign on the dotted line. To date, there have been a few in the UK, a few in Australia, none in the United States that I'm aware of. And so I think it will take two or three or more years to know exactly what the quantitative dimension of this turning point is. But I do think it is, in terms of its symbolic importance, I think at the beginning it was to some extent styled and almost misunderstood as a kind of anti-ecumenical gesture
from
the Vatican.
Indeed, that was the criticism that was
left. I mean, some Anglicans, of course, saw it basically as the Pope fishing in their pond, that is, poaching for converts from Anglican, at a time when the Anglican communion is already in crisis, of course. But I think, you know, more reflectively, what has become clear is that this was an expression of Benedict XVI's ecclesiology, and it's an ecclesiology of unity and diversity. That is, he clearly is a man who understands that the traditional cornerstones of Catholic identity are non-negotiable, and yet he is willing to allow a variety of expressions of what that unity looks like.
Now, there was another event towards the end of this year, which, of course, got a lot of media coverage, and that was the interview book by the German journalist Peter Seyfried, which was publishing basically a transcript of a series of interviews with Pope Benedict. The media focused almost entirely on just one extract, his remarks about condoms and using them as a means to prevent the transmission of AIDS. But moving beyond that, or, you know, just not just focusing on that, what was your take on this book and what emerged from it? What new light was shed on the Pope as a person?
First of all, I think what it shows us is a Pope who is not afraid of tackling questions and giving answers. I mean, in a time when many of us lament a kind of perennial communications problem in the Vatican, in a certain closure of the institution to the media and so on, I mean, what we have is a Pope himself who clearly is not skittish about sitting down and entertaining the kinds of questions that journalists ask, and giving very direct and I think remarkably open and comprehensible answers to those questions. So, I mean, actually, you know, if anybody were to ask me, where do you go for an object lesson in how church communications ought to be handled, I would say, look at Benedict XVI in Light of the World. I mean, it's a perfect model of a kind of fearlessness when it comes to engaging the questions of the world.